So I'm subscribing to the Instagram page Orangutan Word of the Day. And today or yesterday's Orangutan Word of the Day is regret. Which I don't really regret it. I don't really regret subscribing to the Orangutan Word of the Day. I have no regrets. All the leaves are brown, the leaves are brown. And the sky is gray, and the sky is gray. I went for a walk on a winter's day, on a winter's day. I'd be safe and warm. Shut the fuck up! Oh, sorry, okay. I'm parked over here in the carport of the Red Hawk Casino. And it's got a lovely little carport. Looks out onto the fogginess of the entryway to the Sierras. Just looking out on all the, you know, winter solstice. Which, by the way, if you've seen, if you've stuck your head out the window recently in the around the foothills, like Grass Valley, there was a clip on, of all things on YouTube, there's a clip I sent around to family and friends and stuff that my lady about. They had like a foot of snow or something, it looked like, up over there on Monday, which was the day that we went down. There was a night that the lights went out in Georgia. No, it was the day we went to my ex's for Xmas, and this is the story of the survivors. This is the tale of the survivors. No, it was actually quite nice, but shout out to weather, shout out to winter solstice, shout out to this muzak that they're... this canned music that they're playing throughout the carport here. I've got a nice little accompaniment. Shout out to Joan Didion, the literary titan. I didn't realize she passed away, RIP, December 23rd. But I didn't realize what a massive literary lion that she was. The literary lion of Joan Didion, which she... and the interwoven network of her family and friends. It was very impressive. But what's more impressive is she was from Sacramento, of course. And I knew that, but it didn't occur to me. It never really, I didn't piece it together that, you know, look, usually if somebody's from Sacramento, there's very few people that attain the type of success or notoriety that, big time world profile type, well, in any realm, literary, film. I mean, Greta Gerwig's from Sacramento. She went to St. Francis High School. Are they the Troubadours? Maybe that's Jesuit. I think that it's either Jesuit I don't know, they're connected. Jesuit's like this brother school, or the St. Francis is the sister school of Jesuit, but it's private, and that's where Greta Gerwig went, who directed like Little Women and what was the one? Ladybug, reminiscent of it's a very Sacramento film. People that are from Sacramento, it's rare that you see them just attain the level of success that either of those two women have. And if you come to Sacramento as a famed personality or athlete or something like that, that's typically where great people go to kind of fade away into obscurity. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger said it best when he was governor of California. He said Sacramento is Native America, is the Native American word for nothing to do after 8 o'clock. So that could very well be the truth. But that being said, Joan Didion, what a, there's a, there's a, like a documentary, yeah, a profile documentary of her on Netflix now called The Center Will Not Hold, The Life of Joan Didion. And she, what an extraordinary, man, what a life she led. And she, it was done by her nephew, I think, is it? Yeah. Her nephew's Griffin Dunn, who was in, he's an actor. He was in like Johnny Dangerously. He played Michael Keaton's brother in Johnny Dangerously. He was the lead. He was the main guy in this movie called After Hours, which was made by Martin Scorsese, which is one of his more interesting and off the cuff type movies. It's a very out of character for his other kind of mob like stories like Casino and Goodfellas, Raging Bull, that tone. After Hours is a bizarre movie. It's very good. It's very engrossing. And he gets fucked up in that movie. Oh yeah, and he's in American Werewolf in London too, of course. He's the guy that got maimed by the werewolf kind of near the beginning there, and then reappears throughout the course of the movie as a slowly decaying corpse. But so he did the doc on his aunt Joan Didion, who I don't know how the family, let's see, his dad or his uncle, so Joan was a aunt by marriage, and his uncle was John Gregory Dunn, who was married to Joan Didion. He was a writer as well, and they were like these and then what's even more strange is like Griffin Dunn's, I think it's his niece or his, somehow related to the girl that was in Poltergeist that got stabbed by her boyfriend. Her name is Dominique Dunn, but she's related to them as well. So kind of an interesting little web of families and relations. But RIP to Joan Didion. She was literally a literary just juggernaut, just a titan. She wrote for Vogue magazine, she wrote for Time magazine, but she wrote several novels, some nonfiction, some fiction. Her first book was called Run River, which was in and around and kind of about a Sacramento family. And then, but she was like fearless. When the Reagan administration was propping up the regime in El Salvador during the 80s, she wanted to go down there and see the atrocities and write about it. And she was by no means, I mean, she self-admittedly was petrified of the experience, but she was just this gutsy writer that just went in, just dove in head first, and just was just really a very deliberate personality. And there was just something, I don't know, looking at pictures, I've never read one word of hers. I think subconsciously I knew that she was from Sacramento, but I just didn't, it never, I don't know, the situation never compelled me or never gripped me enough to like delve into her canon of work. But the documentary was really interesting. She led a fascinating life. She was always writing. And according to the doc, she wrote to kind of make sense of situations. So like I say, the regime in El Salvador, that the Reagan in the 80s, the Reagan administration, like 82, 83 was propping up and supporting for reasons nobody can really understand. She was writing constantly. She wrote screenplays. She wrote the screenplay to a movie called Panic in Needle Park, which was Al Pacino's first movie. I think she wrote plays. God, she's always writing, just savage and just very stylish. And she would have parties. She lived in L.A. or the Hollywood area for a spell. She lived in New York and L.A. Back when you can kind of afford it, and they paid writers commensurately for their work. And so she would host parties with Warren Beatty and people like Warren Beatty had like this thing for her. She had just all kinds of high-level celebrities, the Mamas and the Papas, Michelle Phillips, people like that. You know, all the leaves are brown, the leaves are brown, and the sky is gray, and the sky is gray. But very authentic. She was very, I have to believe, based on what I saw, she was a very, like, you got what you saw, what you see is what you got, you know? And she was, seemed like a very strong person. She succeeded both her husband, who died in 2003, so she outlived him by 18 years. Oddly enough, he died, I think, on Christmas Eve, which is weird because she died on the 23rd, but he died in 2003. And then 2 years later, her daughter, which she was adopted, she had passed away, but had led kind of a interesting life as well. But that's this whole side story, but yeah. But to lose your daughter, whether adopted or not, and outlive your husband is something that's hard, you know, very hard, I'm sure. And she even had I think she had MS, multiple sclerosis, I believe, or a variation of Parkinson's. She was just skin and bones near the end, but she was still very lucid and very animated and very descriptive. And her brain, you just couldn't keep her brain down. It was to watch her. I mean, the poor girl. She looked like a cadaver near the end, but she was very articulate, very animated. Anyway, R.I.P. Joan Didion. But authenticity was kind of a very, I don't know, I've been fixated on the notion of authenticity and what it means these days. And never more so, I guess, than dealing head on with, and this by no means was by design, but to take my lady to my ex-wife's Christmas gathering, where my ex-in-laws, my kids, my brother-in-law, my sister, her kid, my niece, nephew, they were all there. You know, it was, all in all, I felt kind of, I don't know, you've got to be authentic. You've got to authenticate yourself to the situation. So I drove down. The weather was, like I say, it was gnarly that day. The 27th, it was like one of those, like, these dark, dark, dark patches of solid clouds off to one side that were just pelting down. And then on the outer rim of that was just pure sunshine. So it was like a real weird, strange weather patterns. And that weather, those clouds made their way up to Grass Valley and dumped all that snow, which I'm going up to Saturday. Because I'm going to do some, I've been fixated on doing some snow camping. And I talked to my brother-in-law about it at the Christmas gathering that we did. Xmas at the X's. And, but like I say, I met this thing head on. We were invited. I'm reticent at best. Or ambivalent at best, but reticent first and foremost, probably in the desire to go to any function like this, let alone this particular one. But somehow we backed into it. My lady was just kind of on a roll. She got vaccinated. She couldn't go to the Thanksgiving because of that. So she felt compelled to do that. And, I admire her for it. I mean, it's kind of a non-event now to be vaccinated. Again, I don't support the mandates, but it does give you a bit of a buffer if, in fact, you do get exposed to the virus, which I think ultimately will replace the flu as the seasonal malady from here on out. We're living with this thing. So buckle up and get used to it, folks. It sucks, okay? But these politicians can suck a fart out of my butt if they think they're going to keep continuing with these mandates. Because my daughter, Chloe, who is she's studying human biology and society at UCLA, says that that's what viruses do. They just mutate. I mean, that's what the flu does. Every year, you get a mutation of the flu every year. It's just you don't know which variant it is. That's why it's kind of a crapshoot. If you get the flu shot, you might get sick, you might not, because they're just gambling on which variant you're going to have. And that's the same now that's happening with the COVID. Pretty soon we're going to be like, it's COVID season. It's not flu season, it's COVID season. So buckle up, get used to it, folks. All right, all right, all right, all right, all right. But authenticity, so getting back to this, so my lady and I, we picked up my mom, and my poor mom, she just wants to see her grandkids, you know, and she just wants everybody to get along, and so do I. But she has to put up with my maniacal ass, who's telling her about the variants and how, you know, that, you know, for decades we are, you know, all of society is anti-pharmaceutical, but now all of a sudden, it's the greatest thing. Like, we have to do this now. CNN tells you every 20 seconds to get vaccinated, and then they cut to commercial, brought to you by Pfizer, you motherfuckers. And my mom's really the one I can really be authentic with, because she knows I'm a basket case. But she, I just wore her out. I wore her out prior to, prior to Monday, the day we went to the Christmas thing. So she kind of probably got in the car with a little trepidation, and but she was a trooper, man. I mean, listen, if you've made it 50 years with me in your life, you're tough. So the three of us tooled down there, and about 20 minutes from ground zero, my buddy Mike calls me, and I'm like, guess what I'm doing now? And I kind of went into like a little rough, loose detail as the suicide mission that I was driving into. And it was good for a laugh, but I basically told him, if you don't hear it back, it didn't go well. But so shout out to my buddy Mike. But so we get there, and basically, okay, upon entering the household, I aimed my directive was to drive into this like as if you're driving between two giant semis on a three-lane highway and you're going right through the middle of them. There's very little margin for error. There's about 3/8 of an inch of play on each side, and you just gotta put your head down, hit the accelerator, and go through, because if you stop and start to analyze or overthink it, you're going to get squirrely and you're going to hit one of those semis and it's going to be catastrophically bad. So you just go right in and you go hard. You go hard in the paint. So I burst through the door there. Everybody had already been there. There was like 14 Subarus parked out in front. And shout out to Subaru. All-wheel drive capacity, which is what you need in this day and age, which is what you need in Grass Valley. But so I immediately went in and I hugged it out with my niece, my sister, and my nephew. I just knocked that off the list right away. Challenged my nephew to a wrestling match. He didn't partake. And fair enough, he's a junior in high school, and you don't want your 50-year-old uncle challenging you to a wrestling match, which may have been, I don't know, a little out of character at the moment, or maybe, I don't know, I got ahead of myself. But I could tell my sister, the minute I grasped her and squeezed, she looked as though she'd taken a bite of a shit sandwich, and that sucks, but oh well, that's love, man, that's love. And then I was, and then my youngest was so happy to see me, and she's like, I'm so glad you made it. And she loves my lady. But she was wearing the plaid little vintage thing that I got for her in Portland. And it hadn't occurred to me right away, but because I didn't realize it was a dress, because it was like this vintage rain jacket, a clear, it had like a grid pattern on transparent plastic of it looked like a clear saran wrap style rain jacket with a grid pattern like from Tron, like where they run the light cycles. But it was vintage. And obviously she wasn't wearing that, but she was wearing the plaid portion of the dress. And but I thought when it was hanging up and I got it in Portland, I thought it was a scarf. I didn't realize it was a dress, but looked great. She was stoked. My son grabbed me, yanked me into his room and put on VR goggles. And all of a sudden I'm in some Swiss chalet in Switzerland. And that, I wanted to stay there. I wanted to get on a chairlift and I wanted to ride out of that bitch. But that was fun and it blew my mind. But I didn't know what to expect. I didn't want to sequester myself. My lady was, she was a little, naturally a little jittery. You know, most women are natural enemies in the wild, you know, they're like tigers and lions, you know, like individually they're, you know, beautiful and majestic on their own. But when you get them together, shit's going to happen, you know? So I had to get back out and kind of do a little, you know, I had to double check the situation on all that. But she'd done great. And I introduced her to my ex-in-laws who they're funky. My ex-mother-in-law, she's a 70-year-old martial artist who will whoop your ass if she needs to, but she's one of those kind of like, very reverent and self-effacing types that would be like, you know, it's actually just self-defense. It's not, I'm not here to hurt anybody, you know? And oddly enough, that's my lady kind of, she really gravitated towards her. They really clicked, and she said she could have talked to her all night. My ex-father-in-law, he's chill too. He's a funky dude. They're both ex-hippies. My ex-mother-in-law took 6 hits of acid the night before her wedding to see what kind of back before my ex-wife was born, and to see what kind of, you know, visions she would have for the marriage to my ex-wife's biological father. Cause my ex-father-in-law is not her biological father, but they were all hippies, man. It's just a big 60s blur, man. But my ex-father-in-law, now he's a trip too, because I think he went to UC Santa Cruz, or he lived in Santa Cruz for a long time, and he ran like the co-op down there. I mean, he had long hair. You know, at his wedding, not to my ex-mother-in-law, but because he's got 2 other daughters of his own from a previous marriage. That guy was buck-ass naked at his wedding. Yeah, and I had to see that shit when I was married. So, but this is a guy who's, you know, I spent 3 months in a tent at a nudist colony this year. So, you know, take with it what you want. But, which I disclosed to my brother-in-law as we were talking about snow camping, and he seemed to be, I don't know, maybe that's ultimately why I did it, just so I can see the look on my brother-in-law's face. Tell him I had lived in a tent in a nudist colony from June to September, just to see the look on that motherfucker's face. But no, that's not, that ain't right. But almost, but no, we assimilated into, you know, the festivities quite seamlessly. Naturally, it was good to see everybody. I had my lady try on the VR goggles. We all just tripped the fuck. It was fucking amazing. Like, it's badass. But out and about amongst the partygoers, My mom was enjoying herself. I mean, she was in hog heaven, you know? I mean, when you're with your grandkids, I mean, that's the way it's, I don't know. I don't understand this whole thing, this whole need for grandkids. I am not, I would be more, again, I'm going to be more of the cautionary tale as far, you know, if my kids, when they have kids, which hopefully is not for a long time, if ever, but, I am not to be the example. I try and just, I still think I'm like one of the kids. I still think I'm like, you know, my mindset is like when I get older and I figure all this stuff out, you know? So I'm by no means, I'm not ready to be peepaw or pawpaw or wee-wah or jim-jam or any of those grandpa, pop-pop, peepop, any of those. I'm not ready, you know? Opa or yo-pa. I'm not that guy. I don't want to be them. But it was a good time. There's a lot of energy, primarily by the kids, you know, the cousins, they were yapping away. And the food was amazing. Food was really good. It was kind of a blend of secular and religious. No, I'm just kidding. It was a blend of meat and vegan. My ex-in-laws are vegans. So it was a kind of a, you know, there was like chicken, vegan mac and cheese, regular mac and cheese, crab and shrimp bisque, which was fucking amazing. Like I could swim around. I could do the backstroke on that. And other than that, I got them a little gift card. We rounded up some, Chloe made us all some biscotti and, baked goods, and, oh, God, I've been just murdering that stuff, and it's good, but it hurt. It's good, but it hurt. And we survived. But again, like I say, you just got to go in, you got to be yourself, be authentic. You know, if something's going to happen, it's going to happen. But there was no cause for any issue. I noticed there was contact with the ex-wife and my lady. My ex-wife kind of went a little rogue, and I think they hugged each other. I don't know. I tried to look away. It was kind of like, you know, the last part of Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they opened the ark, I just had to look away because I didn't want to melt and, or, you know, have like radiation shot through my entire body. So they survived contact, and I had a little talking to on the way home, not on the way home, but the next day. But once that stuff's done and it's out of sight, it's in my rearview mirror. That is my, that's my agenda. That's my MO. That's how I roll now, is like, once it's over and done, it's over and done. I don't have the server space in my brain anymore. I don't have the room to catalog this shit. I just got too many other things to deal with, you know? I mean, we got shit, you know, you know, at some point, according to Elon Musk, Earth will experience a calamitous event, you know? So he seems to think in the next 500 million years, according to Elon Musk, the sun will engulf the Earth, as in, like, it will be too hot to live. Okay. And you know, Earth has been, according to Elon Musk, which I believe, Earth has been around about 4.5 billion years. But his objective is the first time. It's the first time it's like we can. Stephen Hawking says that each century that the Earth can have the, or there is the possibility that it will experience a calamitous event. For example, like say like a caldera, like a, you know, a super volcano. Like there's one that's all Yellowstone Park is a super volcano. Okay. So this is the first time ever that we have the possibility to extend life beyond Earth. Okay. We have the capability and we've got the guy to do it. Our boy, our import from South Africa, Mr. Elon Musk, everybody. Yeah. But the window of opportunity, see, you've got to take it. Like, you know, according to him, he says landing on Mars, the best case scenario for him, for SpaceX, best case scenario is 5 years. Holy fuck. Worst case scenario, 10 years. Like, if I don't have to go to any more of these Christmas parties, I might be around to see that. Or I might get stabbed in the neck with a pencil. I don't know. But the window of opportunity may be open for a while, but it may close. And before it closes, see, like I say, estimates for the sun engulfing the Earth are somewhere in the next 500 million years. Okay? The Earth is just under four and a half billion years old. So, there is this, some, you know, before the possibility of an extinction event, we're going to be shipping people. We're going to be interplanetary. Okay. And that is, that's fucking insane. Like, I was listening to Lex Fridman's podcast. He's a physicist and AI specialist. He was interviewing Elon Musk about all that. And my God, the engineering behind that is so, it's just mind blowing. Just all the factors that are involved. Just to build the rocket, and then you have the responsibility of human lives being on that rocket is just too, is so, oh my God, it is so, I have to believe though, if anybody's gonna be able to do that and get us there, it's our boy Elon. He also, you know, I got to give him props to, goes back to the notion of authenticity. Just be authentic. And I think he is very much that, and people don't know what to make of that. And that's why he gets the flack he does. Like, I saw a little blurb he was talking about, you know, because there's this whole backlash about billionaires not paying enough taxes if they pay any, right? But he made a really good point, and he was being interviewed on some kind of like Market Watch or some Business Watch or some monetary economic show, and he'd mentioned basically that for him, as it equates mathematically to pay taxes on his income, he basically is saying that it's a decapitalization. So they're taking the capital that he's using, that he will ultimately put towards the engineering of these rockets and a self-sustaining society on Mars, for the recapitalization of the government. So the taxes obviously are going to the government. That is the recapitalization of his money that he had earned by way of stock in his own company. He does. I don't think he does take a salary. He just, it's all stock. Okay. And there's no offshore accounts that he's hiding money because he doesn't see. Ultimately, I mean, he wants to, like, he likes money, but he likes money for the very reason of putting it into his engineering projects, his SpaceX, Tesla, Solar City. It's all redistribution. So to decapitalize his efforts for us to be interplanetary is to recapitalize the government with taxes. That, what are they going to do with it? Exactly. You don't know. Where does it go? The deliberation of these funds, like years ago, I think when was I in high school, I think is when the California lottery came out, because they had to pass the legislation to get the California lottery out. And the big selling point was it's going to the schools. Well, that was over 30 years ago, motherfucker. Where's that money? Why are teachers still having to buy their own school supplies? Exactly. So the taxes that are coming from, and the proceeds coming from the lottery and other taxes and other income taxes and state taxes to recapitalize the government, which they just gave, I was telling my mom this night, I kind of overstepped my bounds, but they just fucking gave the Pentagon, the defense, $46 billion that they didn't even ask for. For what? To buy more tanks? To buy more missiles? For what? I would rather put that money into SpaceX and recolonize the planet. Build a colony on Mars and be interplanetary and take a vacation to Mars or take a vacation to the moon. We need stations on the moon like we have in Antarctica. We've got scientific stations in Antarctica and the North Pole. Why don't we have them on the moon? Why shouldn't we have them on the moon? Why shouldn't we have them on Mars? Like, this is the aliens are out there because they're a future us. That is us in the future. It's got to be, right? Because they're all sexless. Their arms have dwindled away because we don't do physical work anymore. All there is like this giant head that they're probably telepathic. So they speak without talking because we don't speak anymore. All we do is text. So does that make sense? Does that? Hopefully it does. Like, because just the mere fact that we've just been fleecing the public school system in California, we're like the bottom of the bottom. And we get hundreds, supposedly tens of hundreds of millions of billions of dollars from the lottery? No, we don't. Not if our teachers are still buying school supplies out of their own pocket. And they're still the lowest paid people, you know, in the professional school system. Like, go fuck yourselves. We're so inauthentic in that regard. It's a lot like that movie that just came out, Don't Look Up. I watched like the first half of that the other night. And that's really clever. It's Adam McKay. I was talking about him a couple podcasts ago. He's the guy that kind of came up through the ranks in improvisational theaters of like Second City and Del Close and sketch comedy, Saturday Night Live. And so he's directed Talladega Nights, Step Brothers. What was the other one? Oh, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. He also directed The Big Short, which is about the guys that kind of foresaw the market crash of 08 and bet against, you know, the whole scandal involved with these complex mortgage schemes and integers and derivatives that ultimately virtually collapsed our economy and where we had to bail out our banks, The Big Short. It's a good movie. It's got Brad Pitt, Steve Carell. But Don't Look Up is like kind of a satire, really, about it's kind of clever in a way, but it's, in essence, it's about Jennifer Lawrence is a grad student in astronomy or engineering of some sort to do with astronomy, and Leonardo DiCaprio is a scientist. She discovers a comet. She gets excited, and then he discovers that through engineering and mathematics that the comet is in fact heading for Earth and should hit us in 6 months. So this is basically the caldera, the supervolcano, this is the calamitous event that kind of is foretold by people like Stephen Hawking, who've literally done this, literally said this. This is the extinction event. This is an extinction event. Like, if when it hits the Earth, it's going to create mile-high tidal waves, and it's going to wipe everybody out. And so this comet's supposed to be hitting the Earth in like 6 months, okay, according to their calculations. So they try and put the word out, and they go on TV shows and entertainment shows, and they're brought on to these like Entertainment Tonight type shows that they're just these mindless, horrible, pointless toupees for the mind, right? Where like in one, like they go on with this one show where Ariana Grande is in it, and she's talking about her breakup with some fictitious rapper named DJ Cello, which is spelled with a C and an H, who's played by Kid Cudi, which is funny because like they reunite and did he ask her to marry her? Are they going to get married or something? They go from talk about her breakup to him to like getting married. And then they're followed up by Jennifer Lawrence and Leonardo DiCaprio and their story about how the Earth is, or this comet's going to hit the Earth. Well, the numbers came in and everything looked great for the feedback on the whole Ariana Grande portion of the show. The numbers were way down on the whole Earth is going to get hit by a comet portion of the broadcast. And like they're going off the demographics and they're looking at the numbers, the charts, and finally decide that there's no entertainment value in the comet hitting the Earth. Like it's not that big a deal, because it's not gonna happen for a while, and so it seems kind of everyone's more concerned about updating their social media, talking about DJ Cello, talking about the demographics and the response and the hits and the likes and the endorphins that they're getting for the likes and the the public's more receptive to the entertainment relationship that it's so funny. It's so anecdotal. And it's so descriptive as far as a sign of the times. It's like right now we're so, we seem more enamored with the latest entertainment headlines of what's going on with some bullshit than we are some extinction event that is really going to happen. So man, it's just... it was very poignant, I guess would be the best word. I when I was talking about Adam McKay a couple episodes ago about improv theater and stuff like that, he would be a guy, I guess, in the realm of authenticity, that's a great example. Speaking of like improvisational theater and so forth, like another good example was I guess this is what I mean by authenticity. Like, if you are present, if you are present in the moment and you can engage, like I was saying, like at the Christmas party, there was no inauthentic exchange with anybody there. I think the most interesting part of it to me was talking with my brother-in-law about snow camping, because I had just seen a video about a guy. There's an interesting video on YouTube about a guy who's got a little channel on there, and it's all about him living out of his Jeep. But his Jeep's kind of decked out. It's got the big overhead tent that stays fastened to the rack of the top of his Jeep, and he's literally like in the middle of Central Oregon in the snow, like on the backcountry on the fire trails and stuff. And he pulls in, hoists the tent, literally by, it's like a giant suitcase he opens. Tent pops up, ladder comes down, he's elevated above the ground. Then there seems to be a side kind of container piece that, once it's unbuckled, it fans out all the way around the Jeep to create an awning with LED lights, so he's got overhead cover. And then the back of his Jeep, the refrigerator door style opens up, and then the cabinets slide out to create work tables and workbenches to make dinner. And then he's got like a tripod situation with that he hangs over a fire that he creates in the snow. And then there's a chain tripod type situation that allows a flat circular piece of metal, fire safe metal, to dangle in between the tripod over the fire so that it'll cook whatever he's preparing. So it's a high-end situation. But my brother-in-law is like a troop leader for Boy Scouts. So my nephew's in Boy Scouts. He's like a troop leader. So they actually went out and they did, I think he went to Yosemite is what he was saying. I don't know. He's got to email me all the damn pics. He still hasn't done it. I think he's probably blocked me. He's probably cut me off after I told him about the whole nudist colony thing. But he showed me pics of like how he did it. And how he went out with the other scout leaders to kind of do a dry run, so to speak, on how to do all this. And how he dug out a snow cave. And it was fascinating. And so that to me, now that was engaging. And that ran its course for a good portion of the night. And that was, to me, a great evening. And, but that's the plan though. This Saturday, I'm going up to Grass Valley where it was dumping down snow last Monday. I'm going to check it out. I might do a little trial run. I don't know. We'll see. But that is, you know, that's my escape. That is my escape. But in so doing, see, authenticity to me goes a long way. As I was driving up Christmas Eve, I was driving up into Placerville just before the storm, but it was coming down. It was starting to form. You could see the sleet kind of hitting the ground, and you knew shit was going down. But as I was driving up there, like up in the foothills, I was listening to another interview with this guy, Crispin Glover, he's a trip. This guy's really a trip. But it was a fascinating interview with Mark Maron, who Crispin Glover played Michael J. Fox's dad in Back to the Future. And he's been in a bunch of other movies, but he's just out there. He is out there. But he's legit, because he's one of those guys, he's like me, he kind of questions a lot of shit, and he doesn't like the whole corporate nature of a lot of stuff. So he's very distrustful of like corporate entities and financing things and being vulnerable to corporate interests and stuff like that in regard to financing films or books or anything like that, where you have creative content and they have the financial say. But what he was saying, though, was he did a lot of improv theater as well, just like Adam McKay did, the director of Don't Look Up. And he was talking about he recalled watching this episode. There used to be a show that came out in the 80s called the early 80s called Fridays, and it was kind of like Saturday Night Live. It was sketch comedy, but it was Friday. They were trying to beat Saturday Night Live to the punch, I guess. I vaguely recall the show. I didn't watch a whole lot, but I understood the concept. It was like, again, it was like a preemptive strike of improv sketch comedy. And Michael Richards was in the cast, who plays, you know, Kramer on Seinfeld. This was before Seinfeld, pre-Seinfeld. But this guy, Crispin Glover, was talking about how he was watching, or he was there, he was he in one of the episodes, or was he just... He might have been in the episode, or at least watching in the wings. And Andy Kaufman was in the in one of the sketches, or in the show, or the episode. And Andy Kaufman is... See, I'm going to do a whole podcast just on him, because his approach and his whole vibe and thing in comedy still resonates today. And this is back in the, like, he was big in the late 70s, early 80s. But he just was a whole, like, he's his own thing. He's kind of like this Johnny Cash figure, and like what Johnny Cash is to country music and music in general, Andy Kaufman is to comedy. And a little outside the box, a little indefinable. You can't really put your finger on it, but it's genius. You know it is. But anyway, so he was in one of the episodes with Michael Richards, and they were going through the motions of whatever sketch that they were doing in the show, and all of a sudden Andy Kaufman goes off script. Like, he's off the reservation. Like, he just starts improvising. Like the damn script doesn't mean a thing anymore. And Michael Richards doesn't know what to do. But Michael Richards, he didn't, obviously didn't know how to react. So he just kind of, like Andy Kaufman, as he starts to kind of riff and improv and create a whole new scene, he just decides to, like, throw a glass of water right in his face. Totally unscripted. And this is, like, filming. They're filming. This is on film. Michael Richards didn't know what to do. He finally just gave up. He grabbed the cue cards that he had, that he was supposed to be reading, and just slammed them down. He didn't know how to respond. But according to Crispin Glover, that was the most authentic part of the entire performance, is going off script like that, because it's real. It's coming from you're present. You are forced to be present in the moment. You're not at the mercy of whatever preordained dialogue or mode of thought you'd have to carry into that situation. Now you are you have to respond. You have to be engaged. You know, and that to me is, I guess, what the Christmas party was about, is like being engaged. And I'm probably over talking it. You know, I mean, this is probably a very natural thing for most people, but a lot of people feel like they have to stay on script with something. You know, they have to represent, or they have to. Represent what it is that they're about, their virtue signal. Okay. So, and maintain that dialogue and maintain that presence and maintain that virtue signal of what it is I'm here for and about. But that to me is inauthentic. Okay. Like, we get it. Like, we know who you are. We know what you're about. And that's cool. And I get it. But if you just kind of brush all that shit off the island of the kitchen, off the table, and really engage, start talking. Just be a person and let all the other peripheral stuff just fall away. Then you have, that's authentic. That to me is authentic. That to me is reality. And I don't know, there's not much more I can say on that topic. I really wanted to touch on, the time I had to go up into the foothills to retrieve $27,000 in cash with my buddy Bobby. Yeah, I talked about that. I alluded to that in the last episode with my lady when we were chatting. That's a good story. Or the time that I got a seatbelt ticket for $665. Those are all end of the year stories. This is end of the season, end of the year. It's a good time to chat about. Well, I'll chat about that next episode. That's a good story. That's a funny story. And the time that I toured with the Blue Man Group, I was the guy that was blue. I learned to play steel drum in a reggae band when I was 13 in Negril, Jamaica. This is before Usain Bolt rose to fame, and then kind of post Bob Marley, pre Usain Bolt. But I was big in the steel drum community, and I parlayed a lot of that experience into the Blue Man Group, which I toured with for several years, mostly in the Midwest. But we did a spot up in Juneau, Alaska, as well. So I'll go into that more. Into more detail next episode. But yeah, I just want to kind of touch on, you know, we're about to experience a calamity. You know, there's a distinct possibility that, you know, what if there is an extinction event? What if there's a caldera, a super volcano? Like, if Yellowstone goes off, like, we're fucked. Like, everybody in the U.S. is fucked. So take the time now to be authentic. Be a real person. Don't be what you think people want to hear. Be yourself. I don't know. Shit. It's the best I got. That being said, I mean, why was I painting myself blue and touring with a bunch of other dudes that were blue, you know, in the farm belt? Actually, I kind of made that up. I was never in the Blue Man Group. But I thought it would be cool. I thought it would be super cool. Although there are times where, you know, you're sitting there with a bucket of blue paint and just, you know, just thinking, what if? Well, that's the, I think this is the last broadcast. What's today? Today's, when this comes out, it'll be, well, today's, when this comes out, you see, yesterday was my lady's birthday. And then when this comes out, it'll be the 30th? Yeah. So Friday is the 31st, so Saturday. Yeah. So this is the last broadcast of the year. This is the end of season one, folks. I managed to squeeze in 91 of these bullshit episodes. Congratulations for sticking it out with me. I'll talk at you later, folks. Hope you had a great holiday. I love you all. And I'll talk at you later. Arrivederci, baby.